Okay, and we're going to be interested in this object. It turns out that, okay, so in particular, we're going to look at decay. So we've got one mass that goes to several masses. So decay, you start with one particle and it splits into some number of other particles. Or scattering, where we've got some C1, C2 of the, M going to, what do you call it, Q1 of the UN, something like this. And in particular, we're going to be interested in the case where we've got two particles scattering into many. That's a typical setup in a particle accelerator. You've got a collider beam, two particles collide, and then, 700 pions come out. You've got TeV energies. How many pions can you make out of a couple of TeV? Pions got a mass of like 238 MeV. Quarter of an MeV, so you can make 4 per GeV, so you could make about 8,000. You can get a lot of pions out of a proton antiproton. And you get I think hundreds is more difficult because they do go flying off with kinetic energy.
What's a pion? Is it like up or a bar or?
It's a triplet, right?
Okay.
Plus or minus, and They're the up-down combination. You've got an up-down bar, and you've got, and then a down-up bar, and then you've got up-up bar and a down-down bar in between. So up-down bar, that'd be a pi plus. This might be a pi naught. Some linear combination. I'm not sure it's that linear combination. Might be. And the du bar is a pi minus. They're part of an octet. You can build the octet if you combine these with. You put in a strange part, so you can have an up strange bar, or. Down. I think this is the way it works. The down strange bar. So that's a plus one and a neutral. And then down here, these are mesons.
So they're chaos, right? So strange.
That might be a K naught right there, a K plus. And then there's so down here you'd probably get a K minus and the K naught bar is a different thing. But what happens down here? So down here we have strange and that'd be a down bar. So those would be antiparticles. And then here you get a strange and an up bar would be that'd be minus one charge. Those would be antiparticles. And then there's the anti-symmetric combination here, it's like a lambda or something, I forget what the name is, some particle like that. So there are two linear combinations. So in these diagrams, the way I've done this one, strangeness increases row by row. So minus one, zero strangeness, plus one. But it's the simplest Mason octet you can construct. So these are the most common baryonic mesons. These are the easiest quarks to produce. So you see mostly pions among the mesons. The mass of a pi, I think, is around 238 MeV. Pions are not stable. They decay. I think they can decay weakly. There's a lighter particle like a muon is at 100 something. I want to say 138, so maybe I'm misremembering the 38, the mass of a muon. It's on the order of 100 MeV anyway. So this can decay into that, but that's a weak decay. It involves the lepton. You can get electrons here, or the tau might be more massive. I don't think a pion usually decays into a tau. You need some energy around, I think. But what happens is that strong interactions produce these things. So if you have a quark-anti-quark collision, you can, what happens is, say you've got an up on an up bar inside a proton-anti-proton, maybe what happens. Well, if you're at TEZ, in the center of mass system, suddenly you've got one TEV and no net quantum numbers. So you can produce all sorts of pairs, but you've got a tremendous amount of energy. So what you get at first, you get sort of a UU bar thing bound together by the zillions of gluons in here. So stuff starts to fly out. Well, whatever you make flies out. And it tends to fly out in some opposite direction, but this could be some very massive thing to be produced, and it decays almost immediately into quark anti quark pairs. But these things are producing just a web of gluons. And gluons can easily beget more gluons. So what happens is that these two things go apart, eventually one of these gluons is going to paratriate, a down bar and an up, and then, these things will go off. But these things are still doing that. What happens is you get this cascade where your gluons keep pair-producing until they've used up enough of the energy that things start to coalesce into quark-anti-quark pairs. So what you end up with is hundreds of mesons in a jet this way, hundreds of mesons in a jet that way. And you'll read in the literature about 2 and 3 jet interactions where what happened is, 2 or 3 particles have come off in 10 to the minus 23 seconds and immediately decayed into something else. And what you want to know is what that particle was that came out first. That's a massive new thing, maybe. That's the thing you're looking for. But what you see in these detectors are jets and, these huge particle detectors, several times the size of this room, are, they have all sorts of detectors that detect, the charges and properties. But it ends up in a gigantic calorimeter where you try and capture all of these particles and just get them to dump their energy so you get an assessment of the total energy of the collision. And that tells you how massive this thing was, how much energy it came off with. You ought to be able to add it all up and account for the energy that went in. And the quantum numbers that came in. Like, a U and a D bar here would be would have net charge of plus one, and so you'd add up all the charge that came out, and you'd see, oh, there's an extra charge here. It had to be a U D bar or a U bar D if it's a negative net charge. There are vertex detectors that are about this big. And then there's another layer, and these detectors are built up in layer upon layer of detector that looks for different things. There are muon detectors, lepton detectors. Leptons are a little easier to identify than mesons. They turn pretty strongly in a magnetic field because they're lighter than lepton light. There's a whole lot that goes into the structure of these concentric cylinders that go into these detectors. So you really do see, hundreds or thousands of these things coming out. It takes, on the order of 10 to the minus 22 seconds to do all the strong interactions you're going to do. And then nothing happens for, 10 to the minus 13 seconds. So it goes along for much longer than 10 to the minus 20 seconds. And then you have long enough for the weak interaction to kick in. And you see weak decays that can do this sort of thing. So a pi plus can decay into a mu plus. A pi plus, okay, decays, it's got a preserved charge, so what's it going to turn into? Well, it turns into a lepton, positron or a positive muon, something like that. What was that in response to?
What was a pion?
What's a pion? Yeah. Well, there are these things that hundreds come out when you collide up down bars. We should talk about maybe next when we get to non-ability gauge theory, we'll talk about the particle spectrum and what you really see from these things. There's a good book. I wonder if there's a good newer book on just basic particle physics. I know there's this one by Lichtenberg that talks about the group symmetries and how you deal with the group symmetries. So Lichtenberg's a good one for getting the group theory underlying these diagrams. It's really just a root diagram for a lead group when you draw these things. But I don't know, it's been a long time since I touched on a book. There must be some out for them. You end up identifying the fundamental building blocks of the Lie algebra. There's a systematic way. Dinkin diagrams are similar to this, where you find what are called the roots of a Lie algebra Lie group, and they allow you to construct these planar or three-dimensional diagrams where each root takes you, it's a certain vector, but they're always some fixed length, one square root two or unit length thing. And you build these lattice structures that graphically reproduce the representations of the group, the tensor things you can build around that, the action of that group. And those are the particles. So, let me back up a little bit. You have three broad classes of particles: baryons, mesons, and leptons. Now, bring in mind that all of these are built out of the standard model. The standard model, right? You've got the leptons, electron, muon, and tau particles, and their associated neutrinos down here as weak doublets. And then you've got the quarks up here. You've got the up and down, the charmed and strange, and the top and bottom quarks, which is the beauty quarks. So six quarks and six leptons. And then you have the gauge bosons. So there's your fundamental model. But what we really see when we start colliding these things together, you don't see three quarks, which are your baryons, mesons, and leptons. Well, the leptons are the electron, the muon, and the tau, and the associated neutrinos. The mesons are all quark anti-quark pairs. So, you know, take any quark and any anti-quark, and no pairs. The baryons are triplets of quarks. Now, it turns out that quark anti-quark, we're talking about the strong interaction. The strong interaction is so strong that we do not see what you might call colored particles.
Right.
You don't see a red baryon. Right. If you've got the three colors of SU3, why are we talking about the colors? Because we don't know what else to call the three states. You know, you call it spin up and spin down when there are two, or isospin up and isospin down when you're talking about the weak interaction between the electron and its neutrino. That's isospin up and isospin down, if you like. But when you come to three quarks, right, the triples that the strong force sees, the SU3 axon, are say an up quark red and an up quark green and what's another color? An up quark yellow. Say you get three making primary. Red, blue, and yellow. How's that?
Yeah.
Okay, so they can be anything. They can be, you know, F sharp and G flat if you wanted, but you know, something that comes in threes. Well, primary colors comes in threes, so it's color symmetry. It's just a way of distinguishing that there are actually three kinds of a quark. And there's a symmetry, SU3, that knows about them. But we don't know about them because we only see color singlets. In a QQ bar, right, what you're seeing is some kind of a quark that's red and some kind of an anti-quark that is anti-red. So the net color there is zero. It's a color singlet. So, you know, this could be a red up quark and an anti-red anti-down quark. It's still a color singlet. So, pairing a quark with an anti-quark, you can always come up with color singlets. With triples, you can have a singlet by taking one of the quarks red, one of the quarks yellow, and one of the quarks blue, and you anti-symmetrize on the color symmetry, and that gives you a singlet. Right? That's all you think. You know, there's only one anti-symmetric combination of the red, yellow, blue, all different. So, and in fact, this is the way that they discovered color symmetry, was that all of the wave functions, the downstate wave functions, were coming up symmetric instead of anti-symmetric for the fermionic states. You know, the wave function for the proton was coming up symmetric, and it needed to be anti-symmetric for the thing to behave as a baryon. And they figured there must be some other symmetry that we're not seeing, and so they added this color symmetry that added one more total anti-symmetric degree of freedom to the total state of the proton. And that accounted for it, but it also ultimately accounted for the strong interaction. So these two ways of producing color singlets, that's all you can do. You don't see things. I mean, you can see six quark combinations that are downstates of pairs of these, like a deuteron, for example, can be thought of as a six quark system. But examples of these, of course, you've got the proton and the neutron, but there are sigma particles and omega particles. There's even a doubly charged omega particle. Then there are excited states of these particles. Then you can get strange or charmed or other versions of these things. And if you look in the Particle Data Handbook, which is now online, you will find that there are, in fact, hundreds. There are lots of states for these particles known, and variants where you substitute a quark in, and it has similar properties. But the overall wave function is similar, but you've got a charmed quark instead of a mesons, you've got the pions. Those are the most common. But then among strange things, you've got the K0, K0 bar, and the K plus or minus that we were talking about here. Let's see, what other, there's a lambda particle. I'm not sure if it's an uppercase or lowercase lambda. There's an eta that is, the center of one of these diagrams. There's more than one combination. This is what you get with up, down, and strange, but you can do the same chart with charms or with any of the other six quarks. And if you have enough energy to make them, then you see. For example, there's a J psi particle that's written this way. That's because, what was it? Jeremy Ladd and Stanford, both saw them and named it independently. They were racing to detect these things. And they both claimed that we discovered the J particle. We discovered the psi particle. So that's called the J psi. It might have been a CC bar. I'm not positive that. Is that right?
I think it's right. Yeah.
Yeah, so, the first detection of charm. That would be the lowest energy state, the CC bar, probably. Would be the easiest one to make. You make it in a collider, and an up-up bar, so a proton anti-proton collision could make this. You could also make it, with an E plus E minus collision. You've got enough energy, and what happens if you collide a particle with an antiparticle, which you're making a lot of energy with no net number of, no net quantum numbers. So zero charge, zero this, zero that. And so it can produce pretty much anything in particle antiparticle pairs. So CC bar can come out of that. So, you're in the center of mass, you can go, energy. CC bar. Sit there for a second, then disintegrate, stuff flies off. It doesn't hang around too long, but I don't know what the half-life of these is. Particle Data Handbook. Google that one and, spend an afternoon browsing all of the zoo of particles that was, half of them were known, say, in the 60s when they started building bigger and bigger accelerators. And people didn't know what all these particles were. You had to make sense of this terrific number of particles coming out, but the standard model did it. Right? The standard model, SU3 crust, SU2 crust, U1, with the Higgs and spontaneous symmetry breaking, that whole picture was able to, and has continued to be able to account for everything we see in particle accelerators. We're just hoping the LHC, now running at half its design capacity, 3.5 TeV, we'll see, say, the light of superpartner or something with a Higgs or something really different than what we get out of the standard model. Hi. Any other questions on this?
What were the timescales again for the strong?
So strong interactions are in the range of 10 to the minus 20 to 10 to the minus 23, something like that. It might be a little narrower than that. The weak interactions are on the order of 10 to the minus 11 to 10 to the minus 13 seconds. you know, 10 billion times slower, right? So you can distinguish the two interactions by their time. Okay, if something is traveling at close to the speed of light, let's see, so, yeah, suppose we have a muon. Okay, a muon's not a stable particle. It decays into an electron, or say it's this pion. Suppose we're waiting for this decay to occur. And suppose that pion comes out of this collision. So, you know, up here we've got a pion, and say it's a pi minus, and it eventually decays into a muon. Then, how far can it go before that decay happens? Let's figure that out. So, let's suppose that pion is created with, how much energy should we give it? You know, we've got like a 1 TeV collision, and we create a few hundred of these things, and maybe it's an energetic one, so it's got, you know, 1/300th of that energy. So, at about 3 GeV, something like that. And the mass of a pion is, I think it's 238 MeV. So its energy is 3 GeV. E over M is gamma. And so that's 3,000 over quarter. That's about 12. Is that right? So gamma is about 12. So to get a gamma of 12, it's got to be traveling pretty close to the speed of light. So the half-life of a pion against a weak decay ought to be on the order of 10 to the minus, you know, let's say 10 to the minus 11 seconds. You know, but it's traveling at 12 times the speed of light. Really energetic. It's 12, so this is really times 12 because of the time dilation, so let's call it 10 to the minus 10 seconds. It's traveling at very close to 3 times 10 to the 8 meters per second times 10 to the minus 10 seconds is 3 times 10 to the minus 2 is 3 centimeters. So, you know, it'll go about this far. It gets out of the vertex, right? It gets a little ways away before it can decay into a muon. Now, if it really gets fast and, you know, comes out with 30 GeV, it can go 30 centimeters, you know, a foot. So far. So it goes an appreciable distance. You can see it in a cloud chamber, right? You can see weak interactions, you know, fork and branch and do stuff in a cloud chamber. You get your particles moving fast enough, and you'll be able to actually see the tracks of the decay happen. Strong interactions, no. Even at a TeV, when gamma is 1,000, 10 to the minus 22. 10 to the minus 20 seconds times the gamma factor of 1,000, you're still at 10 to the minus 17th times the speed of light. 10 to the minus 8 off of 17 raises it to 9, so billionths of a second, or billionths of a meter. Way too short a distance. So you don't actually see that. You have to wait and look at these jets and analyze what the total invariant relativistic mass of the whole jet is to find out what decayed into the jet. But the fact that you do get these highly collimated jets tells you that they came from one particle out of that vertex. Other questions? Can we derive some formulas here?
So you only get two or three jets?
Yeah.
Never more?
Oh, it's possible to get more, but it's sort of rare. I know that I've seen, you know, analyses of like three jet events. They're sort of special. and you know, and so I don't know if you ever see four or you know only one in a long time while. But a four particle. See, the thing is, you're always looking at a Feynman diagram, right? So what can happen? A fermion you can emit a gluon, or a gluon, all right, can produce three gluons. So you could get a three gluon event where, you know, each of those now makes a jet. And then, let's see, so, yeah, so you've got two particles coming in, and they collide, and they produce something very hot. You know, maybe an extremely excited gluon. Well, what can that gluon do? Well, it better produce a...
Let's see, can it produce a paragluon?
Let's see, what can happen in this collision? We've got a particle, antiparticle. So, let's see, we're looking at the gluon-fermion interaction. Trying to think how we're going to preserve momentum here. Seems like you've had to have some things coming out in opposite directions. But anyway, once you've got, you know, gluons, the gluon can produce two or even three gluons. You know, these can produce pairs, and you could get three jets out like that. From an energetic gluon. But, you know, I think by the time you subdivide further, you know, it's the end of the jet. Pretty much got it collimated. So you really have to look at what can happen in that initial interaction to see how many jets you could get. And, you know, we'll write down the interaction when you get to FU3, you know, see what can come out. Sure. Decay rate. Hokey-doo. Let's see. Normalization of wave function. So, there's a trick here. And the trick comes from... you got enough pictures? The trick comes from squaring this thing. You see why you need some kind of a trick. Because you take this expectation down and... All right, this thing is 1 plus I t, where that's t. And then your initial and final state, you know, m is not going to go to m, it's going to go to something different. So the 1 goes away, and you end up with expectation value of I t squared, which is all of this stuff. So we have... I 2 pi to the fourth L 4 is the sum of the initial minus sum of the final momenta squared. We're going to square all this and then MFI expectation, you know, all of that stuff squared. And if you square that, the I goes away, and you get a 2 pi to the 8, and you get a delta function at all the momenta, times a delta function at all the momenta, times your matrix element squared. So this is basically what we have to compute, and you see the problem here is that you have a delta function squared. That gets really big. One of them gets really big when you conserve momentum, and then you multiply it by another one. And, we're going to integrate this over initial and final states. Right? You sum or integrate over anything you don't measure. So if you're sending in a range of momenta, or if you don't measure the positions, you integrate over all positions. So we get some negative space integral. We integrate over all possible final momenta. Okay, well that gives us one from one of these, and so the integral over the product of all of the momenta of del 4 of conservation of momentum, del 4 of conservation of momentum, okay, conserves momentum and sets that sum to zero. So what we end up with after doing all these integrals is del 4 of zero, which is infinity to the fourth. Okay, so we resort to a trick. What saves us here is that what we're looking at is a decay rate or a rate of scattering, and we're gonna normalize the decay rate by the incoming rate. So by the time we properly normalize everything, we're dividing by some volume. So what we do is we write this in some finite volume first, and we calculate an expression for the decay rate, and what happens is a volume cancels, and then you take the volume to infinity, and in a finite volume, the momentum becomes discrete. Right, you've got boundary conditions, so you only have a finite, a discrete spectrum, a countable spectrum of momenta, and so you can sum over all the momenta in a box, and then only when you're done with the calculation do you send the size of the box to infinity after that volume is actually canceled out. So this works just fine with this. There's a Wigner who thought of that trick. One of those early guys figured out this was the way to do it. So we need some normalization. So we're going to normalize. The other thing we have to do is make it relativistic. And he does a fairly clever thing here. He establishes a correspondence between the non-relativistic and the relativistic formulas, and then he does the non-relativistic calculation and then just puts in the correction by putting in those factors in the appropriate places, which makes it all a lot simpler. So let's just track through what he does. We have, say, a wave function. Given momentum, position, and for a plane wave, it's just EVI, E dot X. We have this sort of a thing. And the normalization constant is such that we have pi squared, d3x equal 1, and you see what happens here is that you get, right, psi squared, that's just d squared, because the phase goes away, and that says d is going to be 1 over the square root of the volume. So we integrate over some volume here and get that normalization constant. So we're dealing with wave functions that look like 1 over root v. UVI, E dot X. Now, that's all non-relativistic. We'll need to correct this. We also have orthogonality. If we integrate over the volume phi star phi P prime V3X, remembering now that since we're in a box, momentum can only take discrete values, so we just get a Kronecker here, delta P and prime have to be the same, and then we get 1, otherwise we get 0. So that helps. We can do this in broad ket notation just as well. This thing, for example, is that the P prime ket, but we can stick in an X, an identity T. So this integram can be written that way, integrated over the volume. And what we get from that is that the, that's what this is, right? That's the delta P, P prime. But, we recognize this as an identity, so this is just the inner product of P with P prime. So in terms of Ross and Kitts, we also have the Kronecker. Okay, this is all non-relativistic. So if we change the relativistic version, now we get. Remember all those 2E factors we've been sticking in everywhere? If you go back to chapter 4, we actually already chose this so that the D prime, we get it twice the energy times the delta P prime. And is there a volume in that? There's. Two E T times the volume. Let's see. Did I move the volume over here, did I? No, okay. It's this is a formula we looked at before, back when we were talking about the normalization of these momentum states. Let's not dig back and check that right now. This 2e comes up. If you do a four-dimensional integral with a conservation of energy delta function in it, you integrate that and you can get a d3p over 2e. So d3p over 2e is a normalized, and that's actually a relativistic integral. So the state, For space, you know, just like this normalization, what we need, keep wearing your Shadia. Oh, these are the normalized states, so that P is already in there. So a P state is going to need a factor in addition to what these states have. Let's call these states non-relativistic and this state relativistic, and the difference is just going to be the square root of that factor. So if we can do the problem for the non-relativistic states, then free state, we just need this additional contribution to the normalization, and we'll have the correct normalization for the relativistic states. For multi-particle states, you get a product of things like that. So, we have P1 through Pn. We have the product, P1 to N, of 2EPiT times the P1 through Pn. So that product times these states, non-relativistic. So you just get one of these factors for each momentum. Okay. Then the uh,
Is he the volume?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. He's the volume that we've restricted. Okay. So we're going to let V go to infinity in the end. So we just need to check that all of the V factors cancel. That's why we kind of set up these normalizations this way. Okay. So let's see. Tracking this along. All right. The non-relativistic, he has a matrix element M, Fi, and that's going to be related to the relativistic, by just these factors. So, if curly M is the relativistic matrix element and straight M is the non-relativistic, then we get a product over all of the initial and all of the final momenta of at least the inverse of these factors. So 2e ti v to minus 1/2, and then over the final state. So this is initial, final, then we have 2EJV to the minus 1/2 here. So just relating those factors in a matrix element. Now we turn to decay rates. So decay rates are the simplest thing, because there's just one particle in the initial state, and you know, there's just less to look at all at once. And any questions so far?
Why is minus 1/2?
Because, right, this is the inner product of a pair of those states, and this is the inner product of a pair of those states. So, if I take that inner product, good question.
Zero non-relativistic on the left, relativistic on the right, so
on the left? Mm-hmm.
Because it's a good job you move the parentheses over to the other side.
I see. I've got it backwards here. The relativistic has, so
the two equations are congruent with each other.
This is the non-relativistic.
Yeah.
Okay, so this matrix element is these guys. So this is the non-relativistic momenta, and this matrix element should be the relativistic one. And so if I take the inner product of these, I'm going to get a product of all of those times the inner product of these, then I divide by that. It crosses. That one. So we'll keep n particles in the final state, but just one in the initial state. Then we square the amplitude like we did over here already. And we get zero for the one because this initial state is different from any of these. It's not going to decay to itself or other stuff. You can't conserve energy and momentum if any of these masses is bigger than that one, because you can always look at the problem in the rest frame of this particle. And if you do that, you never have more than this mc squared worth of energy available for producing these things. And these masses are invariant, so their energy would have to be something greater than not any of the individual masses. Okay, so then we get the square of a delta function, but in a finite spatial volume, let's see, what happens, so we're going to look at decay first, and I can leave that up there, but in a finite volume, what happens is integral of d3x, let's see, right, you know, that's going to go to a finite volume. Let's see, how do we write a delta function? Right, a delta function, right, here's what he says, 2 pi cubed times del 3 of 0 is going to go to just a b. That would be nice. That's just what we need here. Is that? Let's see, how do we see that? So I'm trying to get the 2 pi here. So if we had e to the I t x integrated, say p dot x integrated d3 x, that's 2 pi cubed times the delta function of t, del 3 of t. And if we take the limit as t goes to 0 of this equation, what are we going to get? Well, if t goes to 0 here, we get integral d3x, and that's going to be just the volume on this side. On this side, we get 2 pi cubed times delta of del 3 of 0. So just the expression for a delta function in the limit of zero momentum expressed on a finite volume will give us this relationship. So it's this that we wanted. 2 pi cubed del 3 of 0 is going to be replaced by the volume V in this finite volume. So integrals are going to go to sums, and it's probably just a completeness relation. For space-time, we're going to have 2 pi to the 4th, del 4 of 0 is going to be equivalent to the volume times a total time where the time is, you know, some interval from minus big T over 2 to plus big T over 2, something like that. So we take a finite volume in time as well. And since we're going to be looking at decay rates, we're going to do it per unit time. That would get rid of that T. So both of those go to infinity. Capital T is going to go to infinity, and capital V is going to go to infinity. Okay, what else? So the delta function, this thing. Alright, so we have a product of two delta functions. Let's see, what does it do with these factors now? There's one of the 2 pi to the 4th factors stays with the delta function. So what we're going to have is 2 pi to the 4th left from one of them. We're going to have conservation of momentum, total in minus out momentum times the other one evaluated at 0, because this one sets the sum of all the momentum to 0, so we get a V times a T instead here for the second delta function. And then we have MFI, that curly MFI squared. So we can replace it like that in the finite volume. So far, so good. Okay, so now we sum over all final states. There's only one initial state. There's only one initial state because we're looking at a single decay. But for final states, we have to sum over all of the final particles. And the correspondence there, so the sum over final states . All right, so we have a sum over momenta is essentially an integral over all momenta with, again, a normalization factor. Actually, you know, what we're doing here is it's a sum over the whole phase space, d3t over 2 pi h bar cubed. So in units of Planck constant, we're summing over the whole phase space. But this turns into just a volume times integral d3p, and then we've got we have our usual 2 pi cubed here. H bar is 1. So we get just, exactly that. And this is really where it comes from, is integrating over the whole phase space of the collision of the decay. Now, probability for decay. In the volume element C3PI. So each of these lies in the corresponding volume element. All right, then that's going to be, let's call that CW, is equal to just this factor integrated over the final state. So we have that probability is 2 pi. Because now, are we relativistic or not? A little of each. Total initial minus total final. Okay, so we know we're actually going to have these four-dimensional delta functions. And then we have volume times time. Well, and we have time in the non-relativistic case as well. Then the square of the matrix element. And then we have this phase space factor. The product over all of the final particles, d3pi over 2 pi cubed, like that. Not the integral, just the factor. Okay, so this is the probability that lies in that. So if we want the total probability, if we don't measure any of the final momenta, we just sum it all, then we would integrate over all these. Okay, suppose we've got something that decays into two particles, and one's a photon that goes off, and the other is something that we detect. We may detect it at a particular angle, you know, phi and theta. And what we would do in that case is integrate this over all but the phi and theta of that particle we're detecting. So you'd integrate over all photons because you don't know where it went. But then you would leave d theta and d phi for the theta and phi directions of the final momentum of the particle you're measuring, and you'd have a differential cross-section. So you'd be able to distinguish the angular dependence of the decay. Might have to do with the spin of the initial particle or something. So by depending on exactly what parameters of the final state you integrate over, or which ones you leave unsummed, you're saying something about what you're detecting, how much information you're actually collecting in that final state. Okay, we'll see examples. We'll do some examples. So now what happens?
So that's each of the PIs? That's all.
Yeah, each of the PIs is a final particle, a final state particle.
Right, but they're all dependent on angle also.
Yeah. This is a three-dimensional spatial integral for each free momentum, right? So dpx, dpy, dpz. So if we fully determine the momentum three vector of the final particle, then we don't integrate overall here. We just
know it
completely.
Yeah.
If we don't detect the energy but detect the angle, then you integrate over the magnitude, but not the direction. And so on. Let's see. Now, what we want is the probability per unit time. We want decay rate. So that's the gamma is dw per unit time. So we drop the t. That takes care of one infinity. Now, if we express this in terms of the relativistic, we have the differential decay rate is 2 pi to the power of del 4 of the total initial minus the total final momentum. Then we have the volume, we've gotten rid of the time, but now we want the relativistic matrix element here, and we had a normalization that I've now erased. This one had which factors? Lost it. Okay, so straight M is curly M divided by those factors. So we're going to have product of 2EPI B to the minus 1/2 product 2E. This is initial and final, say. So EPJ B minus 1/2. And then we have the product B, D3, B, K over 2 pi Q over all of the final particles. Let's see, now in the case we're dealing with, one of these goes away. Let's cancel some things here. Initial, let's just call this 2ET, and the square root of Z. Squared. It's M squared. So, this is going to be it would be that factor squared where the initial particle So that's EPMT for the initial particle. So no subscript on the P because there's just one. And that volume squared is going to cancel this volume out here. In the final state, we've got the product of 1 over the square root of V squared, and we've got the same number of V's here, one for each final state. So those will cancel. So we get the V's to cancel now. And now we can take the infinite limit. Let's see if we've got everything we hope for here. So differential cross-section, let's see, we've got a bunch of, we've got a 2 pi to the 4. We have a 4-dimensional delta function, d initial minus d final. We have our matrix element, relativistic matrix element squared. We've learned how to calculate that. Then here we've got 1 over twice the incoming energy from this factor squared. And then we have a product over, let's say, I for all the final particles of d3ti over 2 pi cubed times twice dp, which, as we said, that is the relativistic d4p. So that's a fully relativistic expression. Let's see, the unit energy of the initial particle. That's it. DP. So energy of the initial particle, EI. Yeah, these guys here are PI, are the energies of the final particle.
Why don't we cancel this 2P, 2 pi to the cube, you said?
We've always put that in our volume element, right? That's the way that our volume elements have been normalized. So that's in there because we're doing Fourier transforms all the time. If we have a pure phase and integrate, we get a 2 pi times the delta function, and that always cancels that. So it's a normalization on our volume. We can define a phase space volume, I think he calls this. Let me just check. N-body phase space. Differential N-body phase space volume. We can call it phase space volume. Element. Differential N-body phase space volume. To be everything we don't want to write all the time here. Basically, this factor with the delta function and the 2 pi to the 4. Yeah. So the IP d by n body 2 pi to the 4. L4 at P minus the sum of the PI times the product of the D3 PI 2 pi cubed twice EPI. All of that stuff just simplifies the notation a little bit. So our decay rate, the gamma, is equal to whatever's left. So we've got a D5. And the 1 over twice the incoming energy, we've got the matrix element squared, and we've got the phi n for the n particle state space. Good. There's our decay rate. So that is now something we know how to compute. So if we want to look at the decay of a, let's see, when we look at the decay of anything we have Feynman rules for, we can do that. So I suppose we can look at the decay in, say, Mandefy cube theory for the scalar fields. We could look at the decay rate for a single phi particle into a pair of phi particles. That's something that, you know, according to those Feynman rules, could probably happen. So we put two particles in the final state, one in the initial state, look at the rate at which that decay occurs. And in the end, it would depend on what? The coupling constant lambda would come in squared. So there'd be a lambda squared in there, and that's going to tell us about the rate at which we expect those phi particles to decay, those scalar fields to decay into pairs of phi particles. Now, okay, here's a question that we might almost have enough information to talk about. What's the difference between the probability for two phi particles to merge into one and one to merge into two? Which of those do we expect to happen and why?
The first one.
Why? Yes.
Entropy.
Yes. And it shows up here in the formula. Okay. Phase-space volume. Okay. This is the final phase-space volume. How much phase space is available for two particles to go into one? You've got one particle, so you have the volume of all phase space one. How much do you have if you have two particles in the final? Yep, that's squared. Right, so both particles can occupy all available momenta. So you have, in some sense, twice as much phase space available for the decay as you have for the coalescence. So entropy, basically. There are more final states in a decay than there are in a coalescence. So we see more decays than we see coalescence.
It's because of that product, then.
Yeah, there's a product over all the final momenta. So you're getting... With a one-particle final state or a two-particle final state, you've got, you know, this volume squared in the two-particle state, and that blows up, of course. So it's big. Yeah. All right. Next thing is cross-sections. Shall we launch into cross-sections? Maybe we can get through this stuff, too. And then we can look at a little bit more concrete stuff here. Oh, there are even some solved problems. Cool. Elastic scattering of non-relativistic electrons on atoms. So, yeah, looks like by the time we're through this chapter, we'll actually have done some problems. Let's get the formula.
Can I ask a quick question this differential phase space volume? Is that... Where's the n?
There are n particles in this product.
Oh, that's where the n is.
So we're doing an integral over all possible final states there. Okay. Yeah, the thing we have to do with cross sections. Are there any other questions? I should say, if you want to see more detail on this calculation, maybe a graduate mechanics text like Goldstein would treat scattering differential cross section. If you find it, maybe Sakurai treats this. I forget. Probably, basic mechanics or quantum mechanics texts will talk about cross sections for scattering. You can find scattering discussions in certainly most mechanics books, and a lot of what we're doing is just common to those. He refers to Landau and Lipschitz here, and they go through it. It's readily available stuff, so you can find as much on this as you like very easily.
and that P is also a summation, right? So,
this P here in the delta function. So in this case, we have one initial particle that decays into N. So this sum goes up to N here as well. So the total momentum in the final state has to equal the momentum of your initial particle, energy momentum of your initial particle. Okay, so things aren't too different for scattering, but we have to work out the... But what you've got with cross-sections are two sets of particles coming at one another. And you have to take into account the number density of each beam of particles if you're going to calculate the probability of them colliding. So let me just get these terms here and put them up. So if we have a beam of particles beam has mass M1 and particle M10, I think the mass here. So M1 is just the mass of the particles coming in. This is the number of particles per unit volume number of particles per unit volume, and velocity V1. So mass, number density, and velocity. And the target is going to have mass 2 and number density N20, and let's take V2 equals 0. So we have a stationary target, we've got a beam hitting it. Well, this is not relativistic, so we have to fix this up. What we'd like to do is write it in terms of things that don't depend on which one is moving how. Of course, in a collider, they're both moving. Your lab frame is the center of mass frame. Actually, it'd be an interesting thing to work through. If you look at the amount of energy available, suppose you have one particle of mass M1, one particle of mass M2, and you send one of them in and it locks on the other, and you conserve energy and momentum. What's the maximum mass particle you could produce? You know, do it relativistically. Nice exercise. Now, do the same problem. Say you send in each particle with half that much energy. So, the relative velocity of the two is the same in the two cases. How much energy do you have in this case? And if you ask the question in the right way, what you find is that you've got a lot more if the collision is the center of mass. So if you're bringing the particles in and colliding, all of the energy of those two beams can go into the new particle. So you've got E1 with opposite momentum, the total momentum is 0, you can get out particles of mass twice that energy, 2E. Is equal to the possible mass. Point that just sits there. It probably goes flying off the pieces. But the problem when you have a stationary target is a great deal of the energy goes to getting this particle moving. So what you have is you have some very energetic thing going off, not as fast as the original came in, but say half as fast, and the amount of energy that's available for the interaction is drastically cut, and this gets really egregious when it's relativistic. So, So this is why people have gone to all the trouble of trying to get two beams of particles to collide. It's very easy to take a stationary target and hit it with a beam. You know, you always hit. But if you have a packet of particles, you know, how many particles can you get into one, you know, they send them around in packets, not in continuous beams. So you have a packet that's got, you know, maybe 10 to the 9th particles or something. Well, by ordinary 10 to the 7th, not very dense. Okay, if you send that into a plastic target that's got a bunch of electrons, you know, like Avogadro's number of electrons, 10 to the 23rd, okay, probability of a collision, you know, depends on 10 to the 9th times 10 to the 23rd is something on the order of 10 to the 32, suitably normalized, for all these empty space in plastic. Now, try the same thing with two beams of 10 to the 9th particles each. So now that factor is 10 to the 18th instead of 10 to the 32, and you're off by a factor of 10 to the 14th right off the bat. Very hard to get two clumps of particles to collide with one another. So what they have to do is get, you know, big clumps, you know, get up to 10 to the 10th, or however many, get the beam highly collimated so that they're in a very small volume. So you do really cool tricks with magnets and stuff to get to compress that packet down as much as possible right before the collision, and then you do very careful aiming, and you can get these things to collide pretty reliably. But that was quite a technological development to be able to do that. You know, it was, when was it? Probably the first colliding beam, you know, 70s maybe. Somewhere through that period. I'm not sure exactly when they were first able to produce colliding beams, but I remember, you know, quite a struggle just to do the technology to get these beams dense enough that they really could reliably get them to collide. But they did. So now they do. Big increase in energy. Well, so the collision rate depends on the density, you know, number per unit volume of each kind of particle, and it depends on the relative velocity. Okay, so in fact, that's really pretty much the definition of the cross section. So, the number of events Vn in time per unit volume and per unit time for volume dV and time dt is dN is equal to what? Well, there's some proportionality constant, but it depends on the number density of each one of these things and the relative velocity, which in this case is dV, times dV and dt. And I think that, that's the definition of the cross section. Okay, it represents basically a probability for collision once you've normalized by the volume, the time, and the density of your beam. And it's really that thing that we're going to be interested in computing. Now, we need a Lorentz invariant version of this. So, let's see how we get it. Unfortunately, he doesn't do the calculation, and I didn't have time to look it up before class. Part of it's easy. Part of it is tricky. The Lorentz invariant form of what is the differential cross-section, we want that to be invariant. A number of counts, that's invariant. We know what to do with volumes and time, but it's this thing. It's N10, N20, and V1 is what? Well, we take the relativistic number density. And the factor that turns out to be right is essentially the magnitude of the relative velocity. So we have V1 minus V2 magnitude. That's correct if they're collinear. If you have, like, on a fixed target, or you have the tubes that the target particles coming at one another, there's actually a term that you subtract off, V1 cross V2. And I can't derive that for you, but what I can do is show you that this factor is something you get from a relativistically invariant expression. So let me compute the following thing. Let's take Pu, say P1 mu, P2 nu, minus P1 nu, P2 mu, and take the absolute Lorentz square of that thing. The Lorentz square of that thing is clearly a Lorentz invariant quantity. And in fact, it's proportional to this. So I'll at least give you some confidence that this very three-dimensional looking thing is something that comes from Lorentz invariant expression. Why that's exactly the right thing to do, the fact that it reduces to the right non-relativistic expression, if you knew that this was the right answer, then showing that this reduces to that is sufficient to show that, oh, this is the right relativistic thing. But I'm not sure how to argue for this cross product without sort of digging into Landau and Lipschitz or something. Maybe that might be a little interesting thing for one of you to present whenever you're looking for a presentation. Hint. It's probably simple. It's something you can look up somewhere and, you know, and see you practice giving a presentation. So, I'm not going to browbeat you guys saying, like, Jeff's going to pass and the rest of you will fail. nothing like that. let's just confuse this thing and see what happens. But it's good for you. Remember that. Okay, so what do we get when we square this thing? This is going to be equal to, here we're going to have a, let me put a half on this. P1 squared, P2 squared from the first term. And then we get cross terms where we're going to have twice P1 dot P2, a four-dimensional dot product, and we're going to have that thing squared. And then this one squared is another term like the first, P1 squared plus P2, or times P2 squared. Okay, so you see why I chose the factor of 2 here. What's P1 squared? Easy question.
EP? Or is that EP?
Oh. Right. What's that word?
Yeah, four vectors, right?
Did I say 10? What? Sorry, say it again?
Just the math.
Yeah.
Yeah, four vectors, right.
Yeah. C mu.
Negative m squared, c squared.
In a metric we're using is b squared minus.
Oh.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Ok
And then C is 1, so that's not cool. you know, another way to think about it is this is Lorentz invariant. Since it's Lorentz invariant, I can evaluate in its own rest frame. And the result I get will be the same if I calculated it in any other frame. Well, in the rest frame, the four momentum in the rest frame, I just have the mass and there's zero velocity, so it's very easy to calculate, and it's just u in squared is m squared. But that's where it's there. So, anyway, what we get here, the half will cancel, we'll get an m1 squared, m2 squared, minus p1 dot p2 squared. So, let's continue here. A half du, p1 mu, p2 nu, minus p1 nu, p2 nu squared is. Let me write this out. M1 squared, M2 squared. What do we get? E1, E2. Plus P1 dot P2. Now, remember, these are relativistic. Let me factor out E1, E2. Out of the whole thing. Squared. All that squared. So let me not factor it out quite yet. E1, E2 squared. Then we have M1 squared over E1 squared. M2 over E2 squared. Minus, okay, this is going to be 1 minus the Lorentz signature here. P1 over E1 P2 over E2 quantity squared. Okay, now these things are actually very easy to write. Remember, the energy is gamma times the mass, and the momentum, the three momentum, is gamma times mv. Alright, relativistic energy and momentum, c squared here, if you like. But if I look at p over e, what is that? Well, the gamma's cancel, the m's cancel, that's just the velocity. And if I look at m over e squared, what is that? Well, I'm canceling this m, so what I get is 1 over gamma squared, that's 1 minus c squared.
Over c squared.
So our expression, we actually want the square root of this thing, right? What we want is the magnitude of the relative velocity. That's the thing that you usually end up putting in these formulas. There's a factor of the magnitude of the relative velocity. But let's go ahead and finish this. So the square root of this stuff, so we get an E1 and E2. And then each of these factors gives us a 1 minus B squared. So we have 1 minus B1 squared, 1 minus B2 squared. Then here we have 1 minus B1 dot B2. Quantity squared. Okay. E1, E2. So 1 minus V1 squared minus V2 squared plus V1 squared V2 squared minus 1 plus twice V1 dot V2 minus V1 dot V2, let's call this magnitude V1 V2 times the cosine angle between them, all that squared. So everybody see how I squared all of that out? The ones cancel. I want to collect some things here. See, I didn't lose anything squared, did I? The sign seems funny. Why is the sign funny? It wasn't earlier. It's kind of weird here. I may need a minus sign inside here. P1, P2. Minus square root. Let's see. Is the signature we're using? We may have a minus sign issue somewhere. Let's say it's plus or minuses, right? Let's just say that's the value of all that. I'm not sure which sign you're getting here. So we have E1, E2. Further some stuff. Alright, we've got a V1 squared plus V2 squared minus 2V1 dot V2. If I take those three terms, and then the other terms, the ones cancel, and then I have V1 squared, V2 squared, 1 minus cos squared theta. And I'm still thinking I want to take the positive version of all this, which I think has the other sign. So let's say E1, E2 I think this thing's bigger than that thing, so I want an overall minus sign. This is V1 minus V2 squared, right? The first term. If I take the answer values, then minus this term is V1 squared, V2 squared, sine squared theta. That's the magnitude of V1 cross V2 squared. So we get this formula. But I do it much, but it didn't require that minus sign.
I didn't check.
Anyway, yeah, trick calculation. I should have had, let's see, but why would that thing come out negative? Well, no matter. The point is that that square root factor that Maggiore asserts is the answer is something that comes very easily out of an obviously relativistic calculation. The only thing which is different than that are these energies. Well, we had some energies and some formulas. Also, these densities times those energies. Let's see what's going to happen. Densities increase at high velocity because volumes decrease, right? Length contraction of volume. So these have a factor of gamma in them, just like those energies do. Each of those energies has a factor of gamma in it. So this being relativistic, statistically invariant. This will be relativistically invariant too because it has the same Yalom factors. So it's a number density with a gamma for the volume.
Are those four velocities? Or is there, I mean, do you have the area?
Yeah, these are four velocities.
Okay.
So the thing I'm computing is manifestly Lorentz invariant.
So the velocities here with the...
No, those are three velocities.
Those are three velocities.
Yep.
Pulled out the...
Okay. Well then, that worked out. So, that's the answer. Our Dn is equal to the differential cross-section, N1, N2, if they're collinear. We just get d1 minus d2 here. And as I say, this is the usual case. This reduces to that. If they're collinear, that cross product just vanishes. Then we have the volume and time element. And we turn that into we're going to re-express it in terms of some energies. Actually, using this, so we can write the general state. Where should it go here? This factor times the cross section, and we have dv and dt, and then we have this funny factor. And that funny factor if I write this thing as I, is that exactly I? Yeah. Oh, okay, I see. It was minus this. So minus that is minus and plus. You don't have to change all that. I put the absolute value in. So define I to be that invariant integral. Then this factor becomes I over E1 and 2. So we have, let me just be sure, yeah. I over E1, E2, and I over E1, and then we have these grouping things here, N1 times Z. So I multiply and divide by Z. Then we have N2 times the dV that was there before, and we have a dT. So the reason for this is, right, this is the number of incoming particles. This is the number of unit volume in a volume element dV. So this is the number of outgoing particles in a volume element dV. We're not going to integrate over the angles there. We'll get an angular distribution out of this. Okay. Then, integrating over dV, N2 dV, gives the total number N2 of particles of type 2, N1 dV is N1. The total number of events per unit particle of type 1, per unit particle of type 2, in a total time t, is given by doing those integrals. Okay, yeah, let's try and get that. So, the event for a unit time, for a unit particle, for unit time, per particle in, per particle out. So the for unit time, for particle in, for particle out, it's just the probability of an interaction. And that is just the matrix element squared. Ta-da. So, summing over all of this, summing over all of that, dividing by dt is going to introduce a factor of m, if we can just figure out exactly how to do that. Let's see what happens here. So, what do we want? The cross section is what? All of this over the numbers. Oh, in a total time t. So, not per unit time. So, in time, total time t. Okay, that's right. So, what is that? That's also going to be equal to total number of events is dn. Hang on here. Too many manipulations of this at once. So, if we solve for the cross section as d1 to d2 over I, and now if we do these sums, there's an n1 and an n2. Call this n1, n2. This is going to go to the total time t. So we have a total time t in the denominator. There's our solution for sigma. And our total number of events, dn. And the claim is that the this ratio is the probability of the interaction. So that is going to be equal to 2 pi to the 4 del 4 conservation of energy times the integral of the matrix elements. Here. I'm not sure that's what you want, but d3 di over 2 pi cubed 2e, and the product of that over the final state. Okay, that's what he's got. That's the probability of the event. Okay, so that's the square of the scattered matrix. So that's all that stuff. Okay. So what we end up with, for the differential cross section, we don't do this integral. So the differential cross section is going to be d sigma. Then these factors, volume d1, d2, over the invariant form of relative velocity, the time, and then these factors, 2 pi to the fourth, del 4, the initial minus d final, and the product over all the final states, MFI squared, d3, pi, or 2 pi cubed, twice EPI. And finally, let's see. Phase-space integrals here. There's not room to tweet it in. That's still a V. And this matrix element still had all the V's in it. Okay, so this is the thing we had before we started canceling V's. Sorry about that. Okay, so then we put in the normalization. So changing this to curly MFI is going to cancel the factors of V here and here, and those extra energies. So what we get, these energies are in the initial state. So let's see how it looks in the end. The initial state energies cancel too. Let me write that matrix element transformation once again. Remember, MFI squared is purely MFI squared. This is non-relativistic and relativistic. Times, okay, I squared it, so I get factors of the product over the initial 1 over 2 E C D, and the product over the final moment of 1 over 2 E P C. One more thing is wrong. What's wrong?
Oh.
Those energies aren't there yet. This is what's going to put them there. So this is just a phase-space integral, right? The d3x, the d3p over 2 pi h bar cubed. That was our original phase-space integral. We integrate to get a volume z, the non-relativistic matrix element. So that's the integral over all the final non-relativistic phase space of the non-relativistic matrix element. Then we do this substitution, and this factor, this product, is going to be just 1 over 4 E1 E2 D squared. This is going to give us a product of 1 over 2 E Ti over all the final particles, and a 1 over V to the number of final particles. So these V's, we've got some I equals 1 to N of those. Those are going to cancel those V's. Then the volume elements pick up the relativistic direction 2 EP for each one. And these two e's cancel for the initial state. We're left with a factor of 4. These two b's cancel for the b's of the initial state. So finally, we get the differential cross-section is those cancel. We get 1 over 4 times the time. We get our 2 pi to the 4th del 4 t initial minus t final. We get the relativistic matrix element MFI squared. And we get a proper relativistic phase space volume momentum space for each of the final state particles over all final state particles. And where is it? dt. The t cancels.
Oops.
That's not t, that's I, 4i. But there we go. So there's our invariant thing, four-dimensional delta function, relativistic matrix element squared, and relativistic volume element. So we got it. And if we want, we could write this in terms of that phase-space element, in which case it's the 1 over 4 I m squared d phi. So I'm going to put that to 1 over 4 I m f I squared. What do we call it? D phi. For the n state. Okay, differential cross section. So suppose we have two particles in and a couple of particles out. And we measure angles for one of the outgoing parts. Then d sigma over here is going to be equal to, all right, we calculate these matrix elements, we integrate over all the final free momenta of the one particle and over the magnitude of p, but not theta and phi for the one we're going to measure. And then we have d sigma over here is function sine theta d theta d phi, so an element of solid angle. So the cross section per unit solid angle is that expression. And there we are. Sorry, I ran a little past your point. I looked your okay there. So really. As I say, you know, there are detailed presentations of all this all over, and so we'll get to the two-body final state, and what resonances and little processes of physics.